Its real price is with the living, not with the dead. These were hard but genuine lessons all 19th century families learned. Allie's passing surely brought a rush of memories of Annie's death in 1860. As for afterlife, Douglas counseled a sorrowful Rosetta to think rationally. Whatever else it may be, it is nothing that our taking thought about it can alter or improve. The best any of us can do is to trust in the eternal powers which brought us into existence, and this I do for myself and for all. The grandfather did not go to Rochester for Allie's burial in Mount Hope Cemetery. Anna apparently did, since Douglas told Rosetta that he did not want to leave the A Street house unoccupied. He expressed fear about arson and terror, even in Washington. We have been burnt out once, and may be burnt out again, and if burnt out a second time, I have no more strength to start life anew again. We are not among friends here any more than in Rochester. The elder Douglas was racked with self-pity at this juncture. It is our misfortune to create envy wherever we go. The white people don't like us, and the colored people envy us. A depressed Douglas seemed to lean on his grieving daughter as much as she could lean on him. His stated reason for not attending the funeral, however, may have been, in part, disingenuous. Ottilie Ossing was in all likelihood staying at the Douglas house at that very time. A year later, Rosetta's life took worse turns yet, and she begged her father for comfort. She and Nathan were undergoing a marital separation, and she was desperate for help. My breaking up has caused such a flitter among Nathan's creditors, and I am being sued on every side, Rosetta lamented. One creditor pursued the 37-year-old mother of 5 surviving children with a note for $91.48. Rosetta refused to sign, and soon a constable arrived to confiscate all manner of household goods, furniture, clocks, rugs, and even her piano. She was selling off many of Charles's things to make money, as a court was about to determine whether she was responsible for Nathan's debts. I am all torn up, she reported. Dear father, I wish I could be with you tonight and be out of this turmoil. I never knew so little what to think in my life. We do not have the father's response to his daughter's distress, but he likely helped financially. The 3 years after the bank and the newspaper failures were troublesome financial times for Douglas. Charles was once again mired in desperation over money and livelihood. After leaving the Treasury Department, Charles had moved back to Rochester, but his debts had pushed him into legal trouble and damaged the trust between father and son. In 1875 and 1876, some of Charles's creditors threatened legal action and adverse publicity against Douglas himself. Charles sought and received a new job in the Foreign Service with the help of his father, as a man named Hollinsworth pursued him for payments of obligations several years old. Charles wrote to his father in July 1875, saying that this creditor claimed that the elder Douglas had advised him, Hollinsworth, to go to the State Department and prevent the younger Douglas from going to his appointment in Santo Domingo. I am not running away, Charles pleaded to his father. I am under obligations to you in a larger sum by 5 times than to all others together. Charles knew he had lost his father's faith. Worse, his marriage to his wife, Libby, Mary Elizabeth Murphy, was in trouble due to her claims about his infidelity. I know how you feel towards me and would do anything to change that feeling, wrote son to father. Douglas immediately replied and apparently accused his youngest son of dissipation, of squandering money on extravagance and parties. Charles shot right back, saying, I have acknowledged my faults to you over and over again, but denied the frivolity and irresponsibility. His problems were due, he said, to making bad investments, and he maintained that he had held only 2 gatherings at my house in 8 years. He did admit to some unfortunate choices about furniture. In early 1876, Charles's creditors continued to stalk his famous father, who everyone seems to assume was wealthier than he was. A.W.B. Shaw, a Union veteran amputee, wrote to Douglas and demanded payment of a $175 debt run up for services unpaid when Charles had served as treasurer of a county school board. Shaw heard that Charles was heading for Santo Domingo and told Douglas that he would suffer unwanted publicity if he did not pay up the defrauded money on behalf of his son. As in other situations, the father probably settled this mess out of court with quiet payments of cash. From Puerto Plata, Santo Domingo, in August 1876, a lonely Charles, feeling pathetic, wrote in a tone his father had heard all too many times. Under the circumstances of the many failures in life, he declared, I have felt my letters were not desired. It seems that under any circumstances I am to fail in my undertakings, and my life is to be one series of blunders. I have been here nearly a year, and I don't know how I have lived. Correspondence such as this from his children, riddled with despair, must have sent Douglas into hiding in his chimney corner. Charles's travail became worse when 2 years later his wife, Libby, died and left a helpless husband seeking assistance from his extended family in raising his two children. The family was relatively silent on this horrible loss. The burial of Mary Elizabeth Douglas, wife of Charles R. Douglas, on September 21, 1878, in Cypress Hills Cemetery, next to a tree near Corona, New York State, was recorded in the handwriting of one of the brothers in their scrapbooks. It was not only his children who so often pressed the peripatetic orator for money. The Depression had hit the District of Columbia black community hard. Douglas's close Washington friend and occasional political collaborator, George T. Downing, asked him in early 1877 for a loan of $500 so he could keep his home. In these same years, Douglas became a mentor and sometime benefactor for the young historian minister George Washington Williams, paying him a $14 per month board during his first year in the Capitol. When Williams moved out to Cincinnati, he kept his older hero informed of his scholarly habits and endeavors. By 1879, Douglas sent a $1 contribution to Amy Post's ongoing efforts to financially support Sojourner Truth in her elderly years. He wished he could send $10, he said to Post, but Washington has been a financial misfortune. He reminded his old Rochester neighbor that he had lost $10,000 on his newspaper, and tragedies within his family had created more dependence than ever. Moreover, he complained, my position here exposes me to an unceasing stream of applications for help, and I tried to respond favorably to most of them. It turned out that self-made men did not live lives of heroic contemplation and achievement alone. During the 1870s, Otalie Ossing remained very much part of the universe of Douglas's family, as well as his personal life. Lewis and Charles, and perhaps Rosetta as well, took loans from her at times. Her retreat in Rochester, no longer an option, she now spent parts of summers and some autumns in Washington, living at the A Street House, especially after a new wing was completed in 1874. Ossing liked the political hustle and gossip of the Capitol. Her new hideaway, only a few blocks from the Douglas home, was the Library of Congress, where she could escape for whole days in books. Otalie continued to nudge Douglas to make the European tour with her. In 1876, with the continued urgings of her German friends in the Hoboken Circle, she finally planned her trip. In June, she may even have extracted some kind of promise, she at least interpreted it this way, from Douglas that the following spring, after his winter lecture commitments, he would join her in Paris. Some of Ossing's friends were concerned about her psychological state and pushed her to travel to Europe for health. It was a huge decision to tear myself away from here, she wrote her sister in Italy, and especially the long separation from Douglas and from my faithful green macaw, her bird, will almost kill me, so that I am already homesick while I am still here. Her annual ritual of such indecision finally ended because Douglas joined her for 3 special days in early June, visiting the opening of the U.S. Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia. Among the attractions was Rochester artist J.M. Mundy's bust of Douglas. But for Otalie, The days alone with her man were a rare kind of happiness. She called it her experiment, so perfect in every respect. Whether Douglas actually promised to go to Europe the following year, we do not know. He may have thoroughly enjoyed the dreamy conversations about Parisian delights with his friend on their days wandering the exhibitions. Or he may also have, as Maria Dietrich speculates, tired of her pleading and just decided to assuage her any way possible. Ottilie departed on a steamer on July 13th, and she and Douglas would not see each other again for more than a year. After 23 years away from her homeland, Ossing conducted a journey full of spectacular excursions to art museums, the Alps, historic sites and ruins, and especially Rome, where she experienced intense loneliness and a horrible estrangement from her emotionally tyrannical sister. Ottilie and Frederick carried on a correspondence during her year in Europe. She all but punished him with long descriptions of beauty and a historical sense of place at every turn, as she somehow kept alive her hope of his joining her in spring 1877. Douglas continued to confide in Ossing, as her letters show her well informed of some of the family dramas and financial debacles. Their rendezvous never occurred, and likely Douglas never intended it to. Ossing worried endlessly about Douglas's health and well-being as she described the romance and layered character of Roman history. She cherished his occasional letters, as she told of her new and old friends, kept up with news of American politics, and painfully recounted the destruction of her relationship with Ludmilla. Douglas seemed to have pulled back and begun to sever a deep connection in his life that he either no longer needed or could no longer manage with the logistical and emotional dexterity he had so long maintained. The complete severing would take a few more years and come at a great price for the sad, devoted Ottilie. Even before Ossing went to Europe in 1876, Douglas was engulfed in the new election season. As early as the fall of 1875, he toured, especially in New England, on behalf of Republicans. He spoke at a huge clam bake in September in Old Orchard Beach near Portland, Maine, at what a local paper called the largest rally ever held in that state. Some 17,000 to 20,000 people arrived on special trains for this combination of late summer state fair and political festival. Douglas did not disappoint. He told all who could hear him that everything was at stake in the next presidential contest. Blacks in the South faced utter extinction if Democrats won. "I beseech you, shelter us from the storm." At these rallies and throughout the campaign the following year, Douglas made the case about what the nation, and therefore white people, owed blacks. Reconstruction had to be sustained. "Save us a few years more until the old rebels die out," he pleaded, "and we have a chance to present ourselves to hands unstained by treason." Douglas asked his countrymen to enlist in repairing the past with their votes in the present. "I tell you, all you can do for the next 50 years," he shouted, "will not atone for the wrong and oppression of 200 years. At the end of his address, according to the Portland Daily Press, a huge throng crowded about Douglas, congratulating him and wanting to shake his hand or touch his coat, as women were moved to tears and men to righteous wrath. As the election neared in 1876, all knew that the last vestiges of Reconstruction policies and regimes were at stake in the remaining unredeemed southern states. One was Louisiana, which for 3 years had experienced not only continued violence, but also labyrinthine politics that had produced a U.S. senator, or at least aspirant, PBS Pinchback, a black Republican of mixed race and a flamboyant past. Pinchback, who briefly served as Louisiana's governor, and Douglas became correspondents and friends. The Louisianan stayed at Douglas's house during some of his long visits to Washington, awaiting congressional approval of the legitimacy of his seat. Perhaps no other electoral saga of Reconstruction is quite as Byzantine as Pinchback's. Everyone seemed to know about Pinchback's past as a riverboat gambler, a street fighter, and allegedly a dandy among women. Closely tied to former Louisiana Governor Henry Clay Warmoth, Pinchback also had his hands in financial corruption and vote buying. But he was a staunch advocate of black civil and political rights, as well as federal engagement and Republican rule in his state. Pinchback was first appointed by the Louisiana legislature to the U.S. Senate in January 1873. But partisan warfare, as well as the man's taint of corruption, led to one delay or vote to block his seating after another. Douglas, as he tended to do with most accusations of Republican corruption, ignored Pinchback's background and embraced him as a pioneer black politician with a genuine right to his place in the Senate. Douglas had long ago learned that politics contained multiple rights and wrongs. In this case, Reconstruction itself, and therefore the rights of black people, were at stake. In the new national era, the editor had declared that slavery had been so monstrous that the blackest charges and rumor grow clean under its awful enormities. Some become great rowers in Harvard or Cambridge, who would have been boatmen without the opportunities of an education. Others gamble with cards because they are reduced by the laws to other means in the management of men. The escaped slave, who led by language and symbol, knew a useful boatman when he met one. Douglas did all in his power to support the black senator from Mississippi, Blanche K. Bruce, as well as the handful of other black Southerners who were elected to the House of Representatives. They all represented a dream come true, Douglas believed, as long as the Republican Party survived to defend them. Most black Southern politicians came from different pasts than Douglas. Some were former slaves, and even Union soldiers, while some also had been educated in the North, as had Bruce. Few had careers in the abolition movement or had achieved any literary fame like Douglas. They were all Republicans, but struggled mightily to sustain faith in the party as Reconstruction waned. In April 1875, Pinchback wrote to Douglas, complaining about the compromises of Louisiana Republicans, many of whom, he thought, were only interested in unloading the Negro. He worried about cowardly white Republicans nationally, who would ultimately betray black rights. Pinchback looked up to Douglas. Oh God, how I wish I had your knowledge and ability to grapple with the difficulties I see on every hand besetting us. Their people, he told Douglas, needed a great mind to guide them in this crisis of our history. Both men were vexed about solutions. Pinchback went in and out of favor, even with his fellow Republicans, in the bizarre twists and turns that led to a final vote on his seating in March 1876. Seven cold-footed Republicans joined with Democrats to block Pinchback's entry to the Senate by a vote of 32-29. Bitter partisanship and questions about his character led to the final failure of Pinchback's appointment. On the night after the vote, Douglas spoke at a rally on behalf of the Louisianan in Washington, attended by more than 400 mostly black supporters. It was easy to blame the racist Democrats, but primarily Douglas vented anger on the mean and malignant prejudice of race from the small group of recalcitrant Republicans. A great wrong had been done, but Douglas tried to rally the gathering. He still believed the Republicans were the party of justice and freedom, and he trusted that American voters would not deliver the country later that fall back into the hands of the party of rebellion and slavery. After the speeches, much of the crowd of supporters marched to Douglas's house on A Street for one final rally. A month later, Douglas delivered his magnificent Freedmen's Memorial Address at the unveiling of the Lincoln Monument in Washington. The speech assessed at length in the opening chapter of this book. In that remarkable oration, Douglas offered perhaps his most sophisticated warning on behalf of black people about the consequences of a failure of Reconstruction. The fate of the era's transformations lay in the balance, Douglas firmly believed, in the election of 1876. The standing Lincoln and the kneeling slave were either gazing out at an egalitarian future rooted in black freedom and equality, or at their disastrous betrayal in a political culture stultified by racism and economic strife. In this intensely hot political context, Douglas attended in June the Republican National Convention in Cincinnati. Since Grant had decided not to run for a third term, something Douglas had openly advocated, the front-runner for the Republican nomination was the former House Speaker, James G. Blaine. But in April, A story broke that Blaine had used his influence to garner land grants for one railroad and taken a personal loan from another that went unpaid. His candidacy steadily collapsed. Many Republicans concluded that they needed a candidate untainted by scandal. So the party chose the safe, unoffending, relatively little-known Union veteran and three-time governor of Ohio, Rutherford B. Hayes, as its standard-bearer. Hayes was sturdy, favored hard money over paper currency, possessed a Harvard law degree, seemed to have no obvious enemies, and was willing to soft-pedal on the Southern question, which was always code language for black rights. The party's platform was rather tepid on further enforcement of Reconstruction policies, vague on women's suffrage, and promised to prosecute corruption. Hayes strove for an honest, if naive, sectional pacification, a new harmony between the races and the sections. Contrary to those who claim that Douglas did not see what was happening in the 1876 campaign, the order was deeply engaged and profoundly worried. The Cincinnati Convention included a significant number of black delegates, many of whom were serving congressmen. Following after the Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, Douglas was one of the black speakers welcomed to the rostrum. In a short but poignant address, Douglas provided a mixture of entertainment, bloody shirt waving, abolitionist principles, and Jeremiad. He garnered laughter by saying this was the first time he had ever enjoyed the pleasure of looking the Republican Party squarely in the face, and that they seemed pretty good looking. He invoked the battlefields where their sons had poured out their blood. Then Douglas directly challenged the white delegates on the vagueness of their platform and the weakness of their commitments. Reminiscent of the 4th of July address of 24 years earlier, he flung the pronouns you and your down on his audience as they ceased laughing. "You have emancipated us. I thank you for it," Douglas announced. "You have enfranchised us, and I thank you for it. But what is your emancipation if the black man, after having been made free by the letter of the law, is unable to exercise that freedom? And after having been freed from the slaveholder's lash, he is to be subject to the slaveholder's shotgun?" He reminded this political class that in Exodus, the Israelites, when emancipated, were told to go borrow of their neighbors, to load themselves down with the means of subsistence after they should go free in the land which the Lord God gave them. But now, more than a decade after the revolution, he bemoaned the situation. "You turned us loose to the sky, to the storm, and worst of all, you turned us loose to the wrath of our infuriated masters." Douglas left the Republicans with a resounding question. "Do you mean to make good the promises in your Constitution? Talk not to me of finance. Talk not of mere reform in your administration. But tell me, if your hearts be as my heart, that the liberty which you have asserted for the black man in this country shall be maintained." This was hardly the rhetoric of a man merely seeking favor and office with the pliant Hayes. Douglas's courage was both rewarded and attacked. He received mostly favorable press from Republican friends, but racist loathing and lampooning from Democrats. His enemies had noticed the speech. A Port Jervis, New York paper reported that Fred Douglas got off a lot of nonsense about Southern outrages and Republican Party failures to do its whole duty to the colored people in not giving each voter 40 acres and a mule and providing a file of soldiers to take him to the polls. The New York Evening Post regretted that Frederick Douglass will not teach the colored people the lesson of self-dependence, instead of always demanding fresh guarantees by proclamation, by statute, and by bayonet of the rights which they must largely maintain for themselves. The Post's editors had missed the countless appeals the orator had made to black self-reliance. A Tuscaloosa, Alabama paper complained that the Centennial Exposition opening in Philadelphia had allowed a nigger like Douglas any official status. Later that summer, Douglas campaigned vigorously for Hayes, especially in New England, his expenses paid by the Republican Party. For the busy orator, faith and fear marched together. What choice did he have? The Democrats ran as their presidential candidate, Samuel J. Tilden, governor of New York, one of the richest men in America, and the legal counsel to financial titans on Wall Street. A Democratic victory would plainly bring white supremacy forcefully back into federal power, endangering all the Reconstruction legislation. Hayes himself, who proffered a naive goodwill and preferred ambiguous suggestions of a hearty and generous recognition of the rights of all and an end to the distinction between North and South, nevertheless admitted openly that the true issue in the minds of the masses is simply, shall the late rebels have the government? Douglas could only hope that Hayes's particular combination of the bloody shirt and sectional reconciliation might serve the cause of black life and liberty, and not merely Republican power. In 1876, the project of Reconstruction, and perhaps the United States itself, were like a huge battleship slowly turning around as it lost power. Once turning, it could hardly be stopped, even if the same group of officers remained at the helm. That year, the Supreme Court weakened the Reconstruction-era constitutional amendments by emasculating the Enforcement Clause of the 14th Amendment and revealing deficiencies in the 15th Amendment. In U.S. versus Cruikshank, based on prosecutions for the horrible Colfax Massacre of 1873, the court overruled the conviction of Louisiana whites who had attacked a political meeting of blacks and conspired to deprive them of their rights. The justices ruled that the 14th Amendment did not give the federal government power to uphold a conviction against the whites who had committed a mass murder of more than 100 black Louisianans exercising political liberty. The duty of protecting citizens' equal rights, the court said, rests alone with the states. Such judicial conservatism and embrace of states' rights doctrine, practiced by the justices, all of whom had been appointed by Republican presidents Lincoln and Grant, left a resounding imprint on what remained of Reconstruction. In the disputed election of 1876, Tilden in all likelihood won the popular vote by more than 200,000 votes and 3%, but did not become president. When election returns poured in, it appeared that Hayes had failed, but the three unredeemed southern states of Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina were fiercely and violently contested. With 185 electoral votes needed for victory, without the three disputed states, Tilden had 184 and Hayes 166. Both sides claimed they had won and accused their opponents of fraud in the disputed states, although most of the bloodshed and intimidation committed in those states had been against black Republican voters. To resolve this unprecedented situation, Congress established a 15-member electoral commission, balanced between Democrats and Republicans. Because Republicans held a majority in the overall Congress, they prevailed 8-7 on repeated attempts to count the confused returns. As the midwinter crisis dragged on in Washington, it appeared Hayes would become president. Democrats controlled the House and launched a filibuster to block action on the count. Many Americans worried that the nation would once again slip into civil war, as some Southerners vowed, Tilden or fight. And Hayes's managers refused any retreat from their claim to the 19 disputed electoral votes, and therefore a victory of 185-184 in the Electoral College. This cliff-hanging constitutional crisis found an end in what became known as the Compromise of 1877, a deal struck in part in a smoke-filled room of a Washington hotel at the 11th hour. Democrats acquiesced in the election of Hayes in exchange for promises to the South of government aid to railroads, internal improvements, federal patronage, possibly one cabinet position, and the removal of any remaining troops in the ex-Confederacy. Thus, Hayes became president, inaugurated privately inside the White House to avoid any threat of violence. White Southern Democrats rejoiced in what they clearly saw as the end of Reconstruction, while African Americans had little choice but to grieve over what appeared as a betrayal of their hopes for equality. Douglas watched and worried about the disputed election of 1876 and its subsequent compromise. He saw grounds for hope in that the Republicans held the presidency, even as judicial and congressional intervention on behalf of black rights seemed in grave jeopardy. He dearly wanted to trust Hayes. Soon, the new president, continuing his remarkable dance between vague promises to enforce equal rights and actions that eroded or destroyed those rights, offered Douglas the salaried federal appointment, subject to Senate approval, that he had long coveted. Douglas was not silent or out of touch, as some suggested during the 1876 to 77 crises, and he had bravely challenged his own party to live up to its promises. But words had, for once, partly failed him at this turn in his career. Soon, he was sworn in as Marshal of the District of Columbia, and could leave the speaking circuit to a degree. Above all, he had to serve and symbolically lead now, in an America he had painfully predicted, one taken over by a peace among the whites. Chapter 26. An Important and Lucrative Office. When the influence of office or any other influence shall soften my hatred of tyranny and violence, do not spare me. Let fall upon me the lash of your keenest and most withering censure. Frederick Douglass, 1879. In mid-January 1877, a blizzard swept across western New York State. Frederick Douglass was once again out on the winter lecturing circuit. He found himself snowbound 15 miles from Corfu, a town between Buffalo and Rochester. He was unable to get east or west for 2 days, he told his friend Amy Post, who had long been an important confidant. With the assistance of 7 locomotives, he slowly reached Buffalo on tracks overlaid with snowdrifts. Almost unbelievably, his destination on this trip was first Detroit and then Traverse City, Michigan, far up in the northwest corner of that state's lower peninsula. I am now about disgusted with my tour, and wish myself back under your hospitable roof, he wrote to Mrs. Post. But the idea of duty, which has hitherto commanded me, is still my master, and will compel me to go on. He persevered, and did indeed reach Traverse City to lecture there on January 19th. This grueling 2-month tour of at least 3,300 miles by rail, carriages, horseback, and perhaps even ox cart, delivering both political speeches and the self-made men address in at least 33 towns and cities, took him from Pennsylvania through New York to Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, and back through Ohio to Pennsylvania again and home to Washington, D.C. The tour included all the usual indignities, including yet another Jim Crow incident. In Springfield, Missouri, Douglas was invited, as he put it, into the kitchen to get his breakfast at his hotel. He rejected the segregation and refused to eat. The South is still the hell black South, he remarked to a reporter, and will remain so for a good while longer. That idea of duty, Douglas named, was still the primary livelihood of the burgeoning extended family of Douglases, Spragues, and others. While passing through Columbus, Ohio on February 17th, Douglas conducted an interview with the presumptive president-elect, Rutherford B. Hayes, then still governor of that state. James Poindexter, the black minister of Second Baptist Church in Columbus, accompanied Douglas to the meeting. Even with the disputed election crisis in full fury, they may have discussed an appointment for Douglas in the federal government. Hayes recorded in his diary that Douglas gave him many useful hints about the Southern question. The governor then described his position to Douglas. My course is firm assertion and maintenance of the rights of the colored people of the South, according to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, coupled with a readiness to recognize all Southern people, without regard to past political conduct, who will now go with me heartily and in good faith in support of these principles. These were the two opposed parts of Hayes's vision of the post-Reconstruction South. Douglas had both personal and ideological reasons to share in such hope. Within a week of his meeting with Douglas, the president-elect crafted 3 paragraphs to be used in pending speeches. Again, Hayes searched for a careful, if firm, middle ground. The 3 amendments were to be sacredly observed and faithfully enforced, and a new policy enacted to cause sectionalism to disappear, and that will tend to wipe out the color line. Douglas had long known that even forlorn hope that mocked historical experience was sometimes better than despair. A year and a half later, in a newspaper interview, however, he recollected the Columbus session with Hayes in harsher political terms. In the meeting, Douglas had announced his sense of alarm at the new president's conciliation toward the South. For an hour, Douglas claimed, he gave Hayes a historical review of the last 40 years of the exactions and arrogance of the slave power. He warned that white Southerners considered themselves above the law, and that they had the blood of thousands of blacks on their hands. Douglas insisted that a policy of conciliation would be as pearls cast before swine, and that what white Southerners most needed was to be taught that there is a God in Israel. After inviting God's wrath down on the South, he and Hayes had parted, Douglas remembered, with mutual respect. Shortly after the inauguration in early March, Hayes put Douglas's name forward for Marshal of the District of Columbia. All of Douglas's family, as well as many friends, dearly hoped for such a position. Early that spring, Otely Ossing, for once speaking for all of them, said that the appointment might not only be honorable and lucrative, but relieve the orator of the necessity of undertaking each winter those dangerous, difficult, and unhealthy lecture tours. The appointment as marshal was the first time in American history that an African American was nominated for a position that required Senate approval. The job, which Douglas himself later called important and lucrative, made him part of the federal criminal justice system. The marshal posted all bankruptcies in the district and remanded all prisoners back and forth between jail and the courts. In effect, he helped run the federal court that once adjudicated fugitive slave cases. Hayes did, however, buckle under to prejudice by relieving Douglas of one traditional duty, introducing distinguished guests at White House receptions. The new marshal accepted the slight, although in his later autobiography, he lampooned the reasons for it. The great apprehension at his appointment reflected not only fear that he would Africanize the courts, he wrote, by hiring black clerks, but of the dreadful image of a colored man at the executive mansion in white kid gloves, sparrow-tailed coat, patent leather boots, and alabaster cravat, performing the ceremony, a very empty one, of introducing the aristocratic citizens. Douglas might have enjoyed wearing the cravat and the fancy coat, but had no interest in being a high-placed butler. Odd as it may seem to us today, the appointment caused both a storm of protest and a wave of celebration in the press. Opposition to Douglas's appointment came primarily from a group of white Washington lawyers, as well as a few black leaders and office seekers. "Everybody admits that he is a man of high culture," said the Washington Star, "and thoroughly educated, but they claim he is too theoretical." Some blacks supposedly complained that Douglas was too high-toned to represent the mass of his people. Members of the Bar Association argued that the former slave possessed the incapacity of a child for a position requiring tact, executive ability, and a large knowledge of man. Other whites dismissed him for lacking business capacity. Many newspapers covered Douglas's elevation to marshal with what the New York Times called dramatic interest. The Washington Sentinel complimented Hayes's fervor for civil service reform, as evidenced in the Douglas appointment. But Forney's Sunday Chronicle said the president should have given Douglas a position less embarrassing. One paper could not resist the ironies of this former outlaw slave now so central to law enforcement. The New York Evangelist reported that an ex-constable in the city, when asked by a bailiff if he was looking for Marshal Douglas, replied, "No, sir, not now, but there was a time when he was a fugitive slave when I tried hard to find him." Some journalists considered the marshal's job in the district second in importance only to cabinet secretaries, while others thought it largely symbolic. But the symbolism of a black man selected by the president carried broad significance. News of the appointment had spread with astonishing rapidity among the Negroes of the South, reported the Chicago Evening Journal. Every surviving victim of the bulldozing, violence, and terror sees therein assurance of protection. Such firsts were a big deal in the uncertain racial atmosphere of post-Reconstruction America. A New Jersey paper put wish fulfillment ahead of reality with the headline, "Color Line Abolished." One New York paper gushed that Douglass was the ablest Negro produced in the United States, the Negro longest in the public eye, nearly a Negro Washington, except in deeds of arms. A Michigan paper declared that a new day had arrived in the national capital. An ex-slave is now marshal of that old Babylonian city. Verily, Babylon has fallen. Old abolitionist friends rejoiced in private letters, such as Theodore Tilton in New York. How the world wags. To me, the spectacle of Frederick Douglass as marshal of the capital is a greater evidence of human progress than if I could see either Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob elected by a returning board as mayor of Jerusalem. The Washington Star, which pruriently began to cover Douglass's family almost as a kind of black first family, reported within a week of the appointment that Lewis and Frederick Jr. were hard at work answering their father's letters of congratulations, many of which ended with pleas for jobs. Douglass now played the role of patron in more ways than one. Lewis was soon appointed as a deputy at the marshal's office. All of his siblings would in time work there as well, or in other appointed positions, under considerable controversy. And at least one African-American commentator, Fannie M. Jackson, wrote as though Douglass were what a century later might be considered the first affirmative action appointment. She thought Douglass more than qualified, but the idea that this distinguished man has been honored on account of his color and that we ought to be particularly jubilant over it is not only great nonsense, but positively harmful to us. In language that would fit a similar debate today, she wished for transcendence of race. If anything else but fitness has put him into this position, his appointment is simply a great blunder. It is just this sort of skin-deep qualification for superior advantages and honors that we have been fighting all our days. As the author of some of the most searching analyses of race and racism in the 19th century, the new federal office holder must have observed all these opinions with wry smiles. One of the most trenchant responses to Douglass's elevation to marshal came from the pen of Sarah Jane Lippincott, known by her pen name, Grace Greenwood. A journalist who had cut a wide literary path since the early 1850s, when she was the copy editor of Uncle Tom's Cabin, as it was serialized at the National Era, Greenwood later became the first woman on the staff of the New York Times, and one of the first to gain access to the press galleries of the U.S. Capitol. Greenwood wrote with sarcasm and celebration about Douglass's appointment. She lampooned the opposition as cowardly, bitter society dogs who could be seen barking at the enemy around the corner, and who yelped themselves hoarse and fell into spasms of color phobia. After exhausting all their excuses for opposing Douglass, said Greenwood, the haughty lawyers were left only with their one real objection. He was not a white man. An admirer of Douglass's writing, Greenwood defended the former slave's peculiar education with a flourish of portraiture. Greenwood argued that living in racist America had provided Douglass's education. His adroitness at leadership had been forged in Freedom's High School of Politics. Douglass inspired these kinds of physical and aesthetic descriptions throughout his career. Greenwood fashioned one of the best, finding in his visage a courtly grace and a raw power that took her inevitably to Othello. Not that he need say, wrote Greenwood, so she said it for him. Haply, for I am black, and have not those soft parts of conversations that chamberers have. Greenwood bitingly declared that Douglass's enemies managed only envious vulgarity, and saw in his genius and culture only opportunities to wound and insult him. She saw Othello's visage in his mind, and captured 3.5 decades of Douglass's encounter with white American racial resentment. So, Othello had found a good-paying job. For his part, Douglass later remembered this episode with measured perspective, writing, "An appointment to any important and lucrative office brings praise and congratulation on the one hand, and much abuse and disparagement on the other." If only serving as marshal, though, had been as dramatic as becoming marshal. The marshalship gave Douglass a new kind of fame. In April, Frank Leslie's Illustrated newspaper ran a lithograph depicting Douglass in his office, greeting a line of both elderly and young black well-wishers. The stout and dignified Douglas is the epitome of respectability, while the picture is set off by a white aide behind him who cannot be bothered to stop reading his morning newspaper. Soon after taking the office, Douglas experienced yet another post-slavery reunion. After 41 years, the Harris brothers, John and Henry, with whom Fred Bailey had shared the life-altering escape plot and deep bond of friendship on the Freeland farm in 1836, discovered their old comrade. John, who had worked for years in a Baltimore shipyard and accompanied by the son of another brother, William, followed the publicity about the famous marshal and came to Washington to see him. Henry apparently did not make the journey from the Eastern Shore. Douglas would have relished such a meeting with Henry, the one to whom he had been chained in their humiliating trek to jail in Easton. We can imagine the strange pleasure and discomfort of this encounter of former slaves, one an unknown dock worker, the other a national, political, and literary celebrity. Douglas's private life, as well as his every public action, more and more became newsworthy. As he found footing in official Washington, he began to embody a series of contradictions that both enriched and circumscribed his life. He was now the outsider who would be the insider, an anointed symbol and heroic icon of the past who still wanted to be the activist in the present. Would he grow old and lose his voice in appointed office, or still be a voice of resistance and protest? Would his leadership slip into the merely emblematic or fiercely resist all forms of white supremacy? Entering his 60s, was he a figure of the past or still of the future? How would the country's most famous former slave balance vengeance with forgiveness in this era of increasing sectional reconciliation? How would Douglas help blacks and whites remember or forget the great epic they had just endured? How could a bureaucrat remain a radical? The philosopher Cornel West meditated on this question of whether Douglas fell out of touch in his later years as he became a Republican, making some vulgar compromises. The freedom fighter, who shifted from prudence to opportunism, argues West, ended up defanged as the insider in Washington. West wishes Douglas might have sided with the populist movement instead of embracing a political system that could absorb him, incorporate him, diffuse his fire. These sentiments have some veracity. Douglas had to grow old in the Gilded Age, make a living for all those around him, while embodying a living symbol as few others ever have. But Othello needed new occupations and livelihoods. He forever remade himself, and such an imperative was no less the case in post-Reconstruction America than in his earlier heroic life. Many have wished upon the old orator a sterner economic analysis of inequality, or a less triumphal advocacy of self-reliance. But he lived his life in the 19th century as a consummate political liberal. It further does little good to ask, with West, where is the voice of the early Douglas, as Jim Crow is developing in the 1870s and 1880s? That voice changed, and emerged less aggressively, perhaps. But it never died. He kept his fangs filed on issues of racism, violence, states' rights, and the nation's memory. He had been Jim Crowed so many times he quit counting. He answered such humiliations with dignity, eloquence, disobedience, and intelligence. West does consider Douglas deeply prophetic, a voice of wisdom beyond his time. And West acknowledges that Douglas understood that you don't find truth in the middle of the road. You find truth beneath the superficial, mediocre, mainstream dialogue, buried, hidden, and when you connect with that truth, you have to take a stand. Some freedom fighters wear starched shirts, cultivate their appearance, and battle evil with words. From 1877 into the early 1880s, Douglas only rarely left the environs of Washington, Baltimore, and other parts of Maryland or Virginia to lecture. For a while, as he reached 60 years old, no more Midwest winter tours threatened his health. In May 1877, barely a month into his tenure as marshal, he delivered a speech in Baltimore, our national capital, that caused a firestorm of reaction. He had now lived in Washington full-time for 6 years and knew its culture. In 1871, appointed by President Grant, Douglas had served a brief 2 months in the Legislative Council when the District of Columbia had territorial status. Because of his heavy speaking schedule, he resigned, and his son Louis served out the 2 years of the term. Douglas might have had little interest in the daily running of the district, but he became deeply concerned as Washington's mere 3 years as a territory came to an abrupt end when Democrats gained control of Congress in 1874. Given his official position, the directness of Douglas's statements about both the racism and the political skullduggery at the center of Gilded Age politics in 1877 was more than his enemies could bear. Initially, Douglas celebrated a transformed Washington, an urban landscape revitalized by the vast and wonderful revolution during the last dozen years. Emancipation, the saving and remaking of the Union, had given the city new life, and the Capitol grounds themselves had been reimagined by the genius of landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted. Under the Republicans' territorial government, and especially the Board of Public Works, led by Alexander Shepard, thoroughfares and parks had replaced the pre-war squalor with beauty and promise. The board spent a great deal of money on urban improvements, including new housing and schools, for a city that had become one-third black. The city was still awash too often in a cant of patriotism, in Douglas's view. But a promising new brand of post-war nationalism reigned. With his hopeful hat on, Douglas declared that men of all races, colors, and conditions were thrilled with the sentiment of equal citizenship and common country. The costs and sorrows of the war still hung all over the city, but so did the new nation's trophies and her monuments. Her witnesses are a free country, a united country, and emancipated millions forever redeemed from the horror of slavery. Douglas announced his own sense of belonging, as he also delivered a full-throated embrace of the centralization of power in the federal government. He denounced the states' rights doctrines emanating from the Democratic Party and the federal courts as a path to disorganization and disorder. Then he slipped his cynical hat on and spoke for the remaining two-thirds of the address about the differences between what ought to be and the historical reality of the federal city. Douglas identified disgraceful and scandalous contradictions all around. He made an argument for home rule for residents of the District of Columbia, observing that apart from women, they were the only Americans disenfranchised. Above all, he fashioned a social analysis of the class divisions and pre-war pro-slavery, as well as post-war white supremacy in the Capitol's political culture. He argued that the national capital should never have been moved from Philadelphia, since Washington was, and always had been, too pro-Southern. He skewered all brands of lobbyists and spoilsmen. With unabashed caricature, he put his hatred of the slaveholding South on full satirical display. Although diminished in stature since the war, the old slaveholding stock of Virginia and Maryland were still visible in the Capitol in pursuit of Uncle Sam's good things with leisurely indolence. The Washingtonian of Southern background was never in a hurry. His gait is slow. His arms dangle since his muscles have had little to do. Douglas warmed to his prey. The Southern man possessed the sitting power of a Turk, always toying with a cane as a badge of authority. This living relic tilted his hat lower than most over his eyes, since he could not abide a manly openness of character. Most telling, the white Washingtonian of Southern influence had something of the Negro in his speech. Here, Douglas anticipated by almost a century Ralph Ellison's observations about an American language that had always evolved as a vernacular revolt, merging the sounds of many tongues. "Whether acknowledged or not," said Ellison, "that language is derived from the timbre of the African voice and the listening habits of the African ear. Slave speech sounded beneath Harvard accents, and if there is such a thing as a Yale accent, there is a Negro wail in it, doubtlessly introduced there by old Yaley John C. Calhoun, who probably got it from his mammy." Douglas had reached the same position, born and reared among Negro slaves, he said, learning their first songs and stories from their lips. They, whites, have naturally enough adopted the Negro's manner of using his vocal organs. Douglas relished the consolation that if blacks are too low to learn from the whites are not too high to learn from the blacks. No one was safe from Douglas's acid satire, especially the whirlpools of social driftwood who floated into the Capitol as office seekers and thrived on the bunkum of political transactions. This included black place hunters who stalked Douglas and any other black man of prominence. Get to Washington and find Douglas was their battle cry. From white supplicants, he had realized that there were a great many more underground railroad stations at the North than I ever dreamed of when I sorely needed one myself. He lampooned the district's large supply of poor white trash, who before the war were generally on hand when a refractory Negro was to be beaten, and they would follow the track of a Negro as a dog will follow a bone, or a shark will follow a slave ship. Since the war, this class all but lived to resent the emancipation, and tried to find occupations by hunting, gunning, fishing, and huckstering. His evisceration of lobbyists and corruption all but did Mark Twain one better. Washington, according to Douglas, attracted more than its share of vice and crime, especially prostitution. Above all, the Capitol had simply never risen above its poisoned past of slavery and racism. Every man of standing, black or white, seemed to require a black boy to do everything for the boss who wielded the whip on the horse, the ox, the mule, or the boy. Douglas's satirical voice had never been in better form. This remarkable speech entertained his biracial Baltimore audience in May 1877. But as excerpts appeared in national papers, calls for Douglas's political head rang out. Petitions circulated in the Capitol. Allegedly, they reached a total of 20,000 signatures, demanding that President Hayes remove Douglas from office. The Washington Star called his appointment as marshal a mistake. Some influential blacks, especially John Mercer Langston, disassociated themselves from Douglas's parodies of white Washingtonians. Under several days of headlines such as An Insulted City, the National Republican ran many pages of commentary on Douglas's notorious speech, calling it a gratuitous and stupid insult to the city. The Washington Chronicle called for him to step down, and the Gazette, a Democratic paper, characterized Douglas as an inspired liar, a dirty fowler, and an ungrateful pet lamb of the Republicans. Another paper wrote that Douglas, the blatant blatherskite, got away with his slanders only because he was black. Douglas responded as best he could to these condemnations. His office was in the District of Columbia City Hall, where on May 12th he was confronted by a reporter who asked him to confirm or deny parts of the speech. Douglas responded that he had been misquoted, and that all the good words of commendation for the city and its residents had not been reported. The defensive marshal wrote public letters in at least four newspapers, denying that he had slandered anyone while reinforcing his claim that white Washingtonians had absorbed Negro pronunciation and Negro manner. Still, he felt astonished at the tempest of rage, said he was not ashamed of a single sentence, and especially lashed back at his black critics. By June, the controversy had blown over, and the prurient press's favorite black celebrity left town on a special journey. Douglas was a proud man, proud of his fame, his tailored suits, his books, his cultivated mastery of language, his physical image in photographs, his position in the government. In April 1877, Harper's Weekly ran a lithograph of a Douglas photograph showing the bearded iconic face from a left profile. That same year, he sat for a stunning Matthew Brady photograph in Washington. By 1883, he appeared famously on the cover of Harper's. But he never stopped searching to unravel the mystery behind his highly visible life, how a barefoot slave boy on the Y Plantation ever made it to lecture halls in London and Edinburgh, or how a wretched teenager in rags in the Talbot County Courthouse Jail ever made it to the White House to discuss emancipation with Lincoln. Douglas could never entirely believe his own myth, even as he forged it. Often he asked himself, "How did I get here?" In mid-June 1877, he decided for the first time in 41 years to return to the Eastern Shore, to St. Michael's, and to meet with an aging and infirm Thomas Auld. Douglas had spent much of his public life seeking and explaining vengeance. But retribution alone was not enough.